Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Do you remember before UFC 247, when pretty much nobody gave Dominic Reyes a chance? Do you remember when the talking points going into that fight were not about who John Jones was fighting, but rather who he was going to fight after that fight? Remember that? Would he fight Stipe? Would he fight Israel Adesanya, who was calling Jones a, quote, washed up old man? Do you remember all of that? Because I do. It was just Friday. And then Saturday happened. And that former high school, actually, if I'm not mistaken, still current high school IT guy, Dominic Reyes, damn near did the impossible. He damn near beat the GOAT. Damn near beat John Jones. And according to some, he actually did beat John Jones. I mean, really, it was amazing. Reyes comes out and he dominates that fight from the start. For the first two rounds, he was landing kicks, strong left hands, scoring at will, doing damage. Over the course of the fight, in fact, Reyes landed 116 significant strikes to 104 for John Jones. That is the most ever from a John Jones opponent. That's history. And for a stretch, it looked like we might see actual history, real history, the kind of history that you buy a fight like this for. It looked like somebody was actually going to beat John Jones and finally beat him in the cage. Because for a stretch, the former IT guy had the GOAT on a bike, backpedaling and trying to avoid getting tagged. Reyes had a perfect plan, and he was executing it perfectly. He was pushing the pace. He was the aggressor. He was cutting down the distance between he and Jones, generally making life miserable for Jones. It was clear Reyes was not some pumped-up can. He wasn't some pumped-up tomato can. This guy was legit, and he was doing legitimate damage. This title shot was not too much too soon, come to find out. The stage was not too big. He said he could win the fight, and he was well on his way to doing just that. It looked like Reyes was picking up right where Thiago Santos had left off. Come to find out, John Jones apparently was not unbeatable. Maybe he was slowing down. Maybe somebody was finally going to track him down and beat Jones. But then it started to change, because that was the first time Reyes had fought beyond the third round. Well, Jones is used to going five rounds, and it showed. Like, say what you want about the first two rounds, but then the champ woke up. The champ was in the building for the last two rounds, the championship rounds, and he dominated those rounds. When Jones was on the verge of having his strap ripped from him, he showed up huge. In other words, he looked like John Jones before it was too late. Next thing you know, the guy's landing just about everything he's throwing in the fifth round. 26 of 34 significant strikes that he attempted in the fifth landed. That is a massive percentage when it mattered most. So then it went to the scorecards.
We go to the judges' scorecards for a decision. The judges score the contest 48-47. 48-47 and 49-46 for the winner by unanimous decision, and still the undisputed UFC light heavyweight champion of the world. John Jones.
So what do we got here? Got ourselves a unanimous decision for Jones, and we got ourselves a controversy, full-blown controversy, and not just in that arena, but in the White household, because Dana White, who said that he scored the fight for Reyes, said afterwards plenty of people were blowing him up about the decision, starting with his own family.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy. My son is in Laguna Beach with a bunch of his friends at the beach house. He's freaking out on me saying, you know Reyes won that fight. You know he did. Yeah, my son thinks the fix is in or something. It's crazy. Yeah, there are people very upset right now and a lot of controversy about all the fights tonight.
Dana White's son is telling his old man the fix is in. You know it. You know it, Dad. Come on, Pops. You know he won that fight. The fix is in. It's so good. Let me clear this up. The fix was not in. That was not fixed. The fight was not fixed. Now, the fix was not in, but the incompetence may have been in. The fix was not, but the judging incompetence may have been. In fact, it pretty much was. I'm not saying that's why Reyes lost that fight. But the judges did get weird with the scoring, and not just in that fight. Like, really, really weird. Like Judge Joe Solis going with that 49-46 score. Let me preface this by saying judging is a hard gig. There are a lot of ways that you can judge that fight. Any fight, but that fight especially. Now, you can say that Jones won, and I'm not going to fight you on that. You could say Reyes won. I wouldn't fight you on that either. It was that close. You can say Reyes won the first two rounds and Jones took the last three. Or you could flip that on its head. What you sure as hell can't say, though, is that Jones won four rounds. You cannot say that. He didn't. I have no idea where the hell that's coming from. And neither does Reyes.
One of the judges had it 49-46. Like, who are you? I might want to have a word with you. But other than that, man, I know I won that fight. I know I won that fight. I was in that fight. I don't have to watch the replay. I was there. I made John Jones look like just a man. I brought the fight to him, and man.
Like, he may or may not be right. I mean, he's right about a lot of that. He may or may not be right when he says he won the fight, but by the way, he may have. And he did make Jones look like just a man in the first two rounds. And he was this close to the ultimate upset, the ultimate win that would have made Reyes a household name. And he came up just short. To me, it all comes down to this, the third round. How did you see that third round going? If you had it for Reyes, he did win the fight. If you had it for Jones, he won the fight. And because it was that close, just about everybody's going to have an argument, a legitimate argument. To me, it's kind of a coin flip. It could go either way. It really comes down to that third round. Dana White, for instance, he gave it to Reyes.
The scoring was all over the map. So Joe Silva, the former matchmaker here, had a draw. Kevin Ollie hit me up. He had Jones 3-2. Going into the last round, I had Dominic Reyes 3-1 going into the last round. My kids are terrorizing me that the fix is in and how can this happen, Dad? Reyes won that fight. And the list goes on and on of people that are reaching out to me. So it's not like there's this landslide of people saying there was a robbery or whatever. People have it all over the place. But the reality is, who gives a shit? We're not judges. None of us are judges. The judges called the fight. And that's that. And as far
as— He's right. Dan is right. Now, the judges there need to do a better job, but Dana said the same. Look, if you're pissed because Reyes lost, I get that. Man, this guy fought his guts out. He had a great strategy. He executed it for the first half of the fight, and then either he took his foot off the gas or he just ran out of gas. Either way, Reyes did not finish. Not the way he needed to. Not like Jones did. If he had done that, he'd be holding that belt right now. If he had handled the last two rounds the way he handled the first two rounds, he'd be the champion. But he didn't. That doesn't mean you don't have a right to be pissed if you're Reyes or you're a Reyes fan. And if you're a Jones fan, first of all, how badly were you sweating in the first two rounds? Everybody was freaking out in real time like he's going down. He got dominated in the first two rounds. You can't tell me you weren't thinking that this is how it ends. Finally, Jones really was slipping, and he was finally going to lose in the cage, because he was. Except, credit the guy. He did what a goat does. He tapped into a reservoir that most don't have. He found that other gear when most others gas out. He did what he had to do. He dominated the championship rounds. He pulled it out. I want to make a really important point, too, before I go to break. Do not come in here with that, to be the champ, you got to beat the champ. Logic. When it comes to the judges' decisions, yes, if Reyes continued to dominate the last three rounds the way he did in the first two, he'd be the champion right now. If he knocked out Jones, he'd be the champion right now. But the way judging is supposed to work, you leave the belt on the side of the cage. When the fight starts, the judges are supposed to view both fighters as equals. You consider the action in front of you in that round, not what the fighters have done in the past. Jones does not come into the cage with some sort of extra point that gets applied to his score at the end of a round or at the end of the fight because of who he is or what he's done. If that's how the judges approached it, they were wrong and they shouldn't be allowed to judge again. Reyes fought an amazing fight. The former IT guy damn near beat the UFC champ. And if you told me right now that they're going to run it back again, I'd be all for it. Especially when you consider the other options for Jones at 205 right now. A rematch is very attractive and deserved. Reyes did not earn the belt on Saturday night, but he earned a rematch. Dana White made the point. They both need to heal up. It can't happen right away. If it does happen, I get that. But I would run that one back as soon as they're physically ready. Hey, clones, the question of the day. What do we want when we're craving protein or we need more energy? I can tell you what we don't want. We don't want another bar or another sugary snack or another energy drink. No, instead we want beef. Pure and simple. So where's the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your old man's jerky. It's not shriveled. It's not dry. It's not tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. So it's tender and tasty. It's not tough. What makes it so good? I'm going to say it's the company behind it. Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for their relentless commitment to quality. And Old Trapper is packed with protein. It comes in four amazing flavors to satisfy all your cravings. It's quality smoked meat at its finest, and it goes wherever you go. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're purchasing. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, be sure to ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? He is Kevin Ioli. Kevin, good to have you. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. How you been?
Good. Good running down, Kevin. So let me ask you, if we go back to before Jones Reyes on Saturday night, what did you make of Dominic Reyes through his first 12 fights, and then what kind of expectations did you have for him at UFC 247?
You know, I thought he was a guy on the way up who had some talent, but who hadn't faced enough competition to really give John Jones a serious fight or win the fight. I thought that, he struggled against Volkan Ozdemir. Some people thought that Ozdemir could have won the decision in that fight. You know, he knocked out Chris Weidman, who obviously had been a world champion, but Chris had been knocked out by other people, had moved up to light heavyweight. So I thought there were a lot of open questions about Dominic and that he was just getting in there with a different beast in John Jones. And I honestly did not think that he would give Jones the kind of fight that he ultimately did on Saturday.
Kevin Ioli joining us. So all of that said, what were you thinking when Reyes came out and controlled the fight early on? What was your reaction to what you saw in the first two rounds?
You know, at the end of the second round, I thought we are going to see an upset here. I mean, at the end of that second round, it was pretty obvious that Reyes had to win one of the final three, and he's the new champion. And Jones was having great difficulty. I thought Reyes created the proper distance. He got inside on him, and he got in a spot where Jones wasn't able to land, and he was able to land a lot of shots, and he was pushing the pace. And I mean, so many things that he did in that fight I was impressed by. And I thought, end of the second round, I said to myself, there's going to be a title change tonight. It's going to be one of the big upsets in UFC history.
And it looked like it would be, Kevin. To your point, you said he had to win one of the final three rounds to win that fight, which brings us to the critical third round. What did you make of that third round, and how did you score it?
The third round was a very good round, and I think it was, you know, the first half of the round went toward Reyes, the second half of the round went toward Jones. You know, I thought that Jones had a few more substantial strikes in that second half of the round than Reyes had in the first half of the round. So I gave the round to Jones. And I thought that Reyes's pace slowed a little bit in the third round. I thought one of the things that he did in the first two rounds, he pushed it so hard, John was having trouble with that. John wasn't used to somebody fighting him. You know, John was in magnificent condition, but, you know, know, everybody fights John with respect, and they're wary of him because of how great of an offensive fighter he is. Well, what ended up happening was Reyes just brought the fight to him in those first two rounds, and John struggled to kind of adjust to it. When Reyes's pace slowed a little bit in that third round, John picked it up. I scored it for Reyes, and to me, that's the deciding round in the fight. I think it was a round that could have gone either way. I don't argue anybody who thought Reyes won that third round. I personally thought Jones did a little bit more, but it was one of those rounds that could have gone either way.
Kevin Ioli joining us. The fourth and fifth rounds, though, did not go either way, really. Jones dominated in those two rounds, the championship rounds. What do you make of the way he responded in the fourth and fifth?
You know, it reminded me of UFC 165. You know, he didn't train. You know, it was a different situation, but he fought Alexander Gustafsson then, and he had no respect for Gustafsson going into that fight. He thought the only thing he had going for him that he was tall, and he literally, that was back when John was really in a party mode, and, you know, he partied during training camp. He didn't get ready for the fight. This was in 2013. Fight was in Toronto, and Gustafsson came out there and was just ablaze in the first couple rounds, and, you know, give Jones credit. In that fight, he picked it up again too. He realized, hey, my title's at stake here, and he roared back and he won the fight down the stretch. That's the same thing he did on this one. I mean, say what you want about John Jones, and there's a lot of people that don't like him. This guy has a championship mentality, and he raised his game when he absolutely had to do it. When the fight was on the line, he stood up.
Kevin Ioli is joining us. Now, Kevin, two judges had that 48-47. That's understandable. One judge, Joe Solis, had it 49-46. How in the world does he end up scoring that fight 49-46?
I'll tell you what, I mean, the Texas Commission in general was just terrible, Jim. I mean, you know, going back years in boxing and MMA, they, you know, all the promoters will tell you that privately, that they have that issue. The problem is, I think that, you know, it's such a big fight state. People love to go there. He was just terrible. That score was awful, and he did that all throughout the show, all night long. He had one fighter winning 30-27 that most people thought lost the fight. I mean, just it looked to me, and I don't say this lightly, like he did not know what he was watching. And there's no way that you can give John Jones four of those five rounds. Absolutely no way.
So how does a guy like that, if in fact he did not know what he was watching, how does that guy find himself in that position on that big of a stage?
You know, I think it goes back to the way Texas regulates, and I think it's a political system, and it's a good old boy network, and I think that happens. I mean, they have done so many things over the years that, you know, you could point to that are outrageous, ridiculous. There's nepotism there. There's all those kind of things, and that's just the way they appoint things. And I think, you know, hey, look, they didn't use the best referees in the world. We didn't see Herb Dean there. You know, they were using local referees. The judges were very questionable. That has been Texas's reputation, and, you know, and I think for the sake of the fighters that they need to fix that. They had a fight years ago. It was a Bellator show. Kimbo Slice, the late Kimbo Slice, was fighting a guy named Dada 5000, and Dada 5000 almost died in the ring, and it was no joke, and he spent several days in the hospital after that, and that was just from lax medicals and lax regulation of the fight. Texas has been known to be bad, Jim, and just in this aspect of judging on Saturday, they really showed it.
So we're talking to Kevin Ioli. Kevin, in the wake of that, there's been more talk of an open scoring system during a fight. This is not the first time that's come up. What do you make of that idea, and how could that be carried out?
I mean, they use it in Mexico and WBC boxing title fights, and it really doesn't work. I mean, first of all, what are you going to get? Even if we know the results after each round, the fans in the arena know the result, what does that change? I don't think it changes anything. But here's a couple of the negatives, Jim, that I think you have to really think carefully about. Let's say it's a five-round fight, so like this fight on Saturday night. The first two rounds, you have two judges score it one way, and then you have the third judge score it another way. Now, you want all the judges to score, give their best effort to each individual round and score the round as they see fit, scored honestly and accurately. So if one judge says, hey, I've been off with my two fellow judges in the first two rounds, and the third round comes, maybe he's going to see it a different way because he's thinking, hey, they're seeing it different than me, and I want to be with them. And now he changes the way he scores. I think by doing that, that puts more pressure on the judges and makes it harder to get a fair score. It also affects the way the fighters will fight the fights. I saw a fight years ago. Miguel Cotto, the great boxing future Hall of Famer, was fighting a guy named Octay Urkel. And Cotto was way ahead in the fight. The scores were out. Urkel was a good boxer, but he didn't have any power. He realized, I can't win this fight. He just ran himself. He didn't want to box because he didn't want to get knocked out. And even though he knew he was going to lose the fight, it was going to be either lose by decision or get knocked out. And he said, you know what? I'd rather lose by decision. There's so many negatives to open scoring, and I don't see what the positive is. What is the positive of us knowing? Maybe there's a way, technology-wise, that they can put it on TV where people at home who buy the fight or who are watching on television can see it. But to have it in the arena, I just think would cause too many problems.
I'm glad I asked that question. Kevin Ioli joining me for another moment or so. Kevin, so where does that leave us in the way we look at John Jones? Like, to your point, I mean, well, he's fought down to his level of competition. We understand this, but to your point, he did show the heart of a champion, if not a goat, in coming back the way he did. Do you look at it that way, or do you look at it as a matter of he should have never fallen behind in the first place and he's slipping of late? How do you view him now?
I think a little of all of that, but I think, you know, that you also have to look at this. You know, John, the sport has changed in the 9 years that he's been the champion, and there's a lot more complete fighters than there were before. And when you have more complete fighters, they're not as easy to get rid of. And you think back to his early days, and, you know, a lot of the guys were primarily one-dimensional fighters. You know, they didn't have the all-around game. You know, Ryan Bader was in his early days as a fighter, so he was more just a wrestler, didn't have the striking that he has now. You know, Rampage Jackson, you know, had a little bit of a background as a wrestler, but he didn't really wrestle. He was just a big slugger. Same thing was with Shogun. Mauricio Shogun Hua, who he beat for the championship in 2011. Now these guys are coming up. They can do a little bit of everything. And I think the fighters themselves are better. But I think John also, he's one of those guys. You know, he's a smart guy. He looks and he knows, hey, I'm better than this guy, and if I give 90% effort, I'm going to be able to win the fight. I don't think it's the best way to go. But we've seen, hey, look, you know, his finish rate has come down too. I think that's directly attributable to the fact that the fighters are more well-rounded.
Kevin, one last thought since I have you. We are less than 2 weeks away from Wilder Fury 2. I had Deontay Wilder on the show during Super Bowl week. We talked about his power and that line that he loves about how his opponents have to be perfect for 36 minutes. Yeah. He only needs to be perfect for 2 seconds. So can Fury be perfect for 36 more minutes against Wilder?
He can, Jim, but I'll tell you what, I think he's making a mistake, and I'm writing a story about it as we speak. He says he's going to weigh 270. He weighed 254 the last time. I think coming in at 270 is going to be a mistake because I don't think you want to slow yourself down. And to me, there's no way that you're not going to be a little less quick if you're 16 pounds heavier than you were the last time. I think you want to stay out of the way of that right hand because that's really the only way Wilder wins the fight, right? He's got to knock him down and beat him up with the right hand. He's not going to outbox him. I think Fury wants to give himself the best chance to win. He's going to want to be able to box. I think he's that kind of boxer, but I just believe that coming in, if in fact he's being honest and he's not just playing mind games with Wilder, I think that's a mistake.
What were you thinking when the Super Bowl ended, if you were not a Chiefs fan or a Niners fan, but just a football fan or a sports fan? If the moment that game ended, you started counting down until the start of the 2020 football season, like, I want to tell you, I want to say, if that's the greatest source of joy in your life, where your ultimate meaning is derived in your life, you know, your favorite team, your favorite league, if that's where you get all your meaning and purpose and joy, I want to tell you, you need to take a nice, long look in the mirror. Because as great as the Shield is, there is more to life than that. A lot more. I want to tell you that. But I know in the case of most of you, I'd be wasting my time, so I won't tell you that. Good news, bad news then. Good news is there really is no offseason in the NFL. That's good news. Bad news is there's really no actual football during the NFL offseason. That's the bad news. Or is it? I mean, there's no real football. There's no NFL football. But to say that there is no football really is not true because there is football. XFL, baby. It's back. It is. Now, no, it's not the original XFL. I mean, they do have some kind of wacky rules for the kickoff, but not that old school scramble, which I still miss. And I'll get back to that in a minute. But when they're really getting loose now, they've got like extra points. And you can run a play from the 2-yard line for a single point. You can run a play from the 5-yard line for 2 points. You can run a play from the 10-yard line for 3 points. So they still get kind of wacky with it. Now, I know the popular thing right now is to either ironically or even sincerely declare yourself to be a fan of the Dallas Renegades. You know, ionically. Or maybe talk about how you're a New York Guardian fan for life. See, me, I'm not going to go there. Not yet. And it's not because Jeff Brohm is not going to be playing in the league, so we're not going to get sideline interviews like this one.
Jeff Brohm, how in the world are you starting this game tonight after taking that hit just 6 days ago?
Well, let me answer that question by asking you two questions. One, is this or is this not the XFL? Yes, it is. Two, do I or do I not currently have a pulse? Yes, I do. Let's play football.
Damn. So good. Other than Evel Knievel asking me, you know the hell I am? You tell me a better exchange, a better Q&A with anybody anywhere at any time. Yes. And he and I were forever tight after that. It's not because the team names are still horrible, because they are. It's really hard to get fired up about a league that's played out reheated team names like the Vipers, the Dragons, the Battlehawks, especially when they're running around in uniforms that look like they're worn by the opponents in a Hollywood movie where they couldn't get the rights to the actual teams. Names that bad, uniforms that bad. But don't get it twisted. Again, I'm not here to hate. In fact, I liked some of what I saw from the XFL, like Jerry Glanville. I like that. Like Jerry Glanville coaching, like Jerry Glanville, as you probably saw, wearing not one but two different headsets at the same time during a game. However, as much as I'm already jonesing for football, something to watch, something to get down on, something for my man James Kelly to get down on, I can't go all in. Not yet. Not yet. Probably not ever. I mean, we've been down this road before, right? Hell, we went down this road only a year ago. It didn't end well. Remember? It was not that long ago that the Alliance of American Football was kicking ass and we were all in. And then it just vanished. So if you want to come at me and tell me it's awesome that Jerry Glanville is back and on the sidelines and rocking two headsets, I agree. That's fine. It's better than fine. But let me remind you that it was also awesome when my man Rick Neuheisel was partying with the Arizona Hotshots in a locker room. Remember that? That was only a year ago. Remember that? I allowed myself to get sucked in. So excuse me if I'm going to take a once bitten, twice shy approach to the XFL. Like when you've seen Rick Neuheisel partying like that and then it gets ripped from you, you're just a little reluctant to jump right back in and start celebrating another league only 1 year later. Yes, I like the XFL's in-game interviews. And of course, it was going to lead to something like this from Seattle's Dylan Day.
I don't know. There's just a lot of chatter after a play. We're trying to make some stuff happen, and they're doing a little extra pushing and shoving. We're trying to get our f***ing job done. They're just
because that wasn't going to happen. We're trying to get our effing job done. I love the way they try and get delayed, too. Listen to it go, like, silent. Listen to this.
We're trying to get our f***ing job done. They're just
So close. So close.
Trying to get a f***ing job done.
Yeah, because that was not going to happen. It wasn't shocking that somebody dropped an F-bomb in an XFL interview. It wouldn't have been shocking. It would have been shocking if it didn't happen. But those of us who are loyal Alliance supporters are just sitting back and saying, been there, done that. Have heard that. Yeah, you've got Dylan Day dropping F-bombs during interviews. The Alliance, though, had Christian Hackenberg dropping F-bombs during games.
They have not. Here they come. Third and long. They get the job done again.
So the XFL is going to let viewers in on conversations surrounding a replay review too. Yeah, but the Alliance did that as well. Although a big shout out to the XFL for having the replay official controlling everything with an Xbox controller. Now that's tight. That's pretty awesome. What's next? Are you going to hook up the replay officials with a Nintendo Power Glove? How about making the refs use the Nintendo Power Pad for penalties? Or why don't we just go old school with it completely? Make them use Atari joysticks. Remember those Atari joysticks back in the day when they'd break and they'd get stuck? Like over there, like at a 45 degree angle? If you like some old school violence with your football, you get that? Thanks to Tampa Bay defensive tackle Ricky Walker. My man became the first player in league history to get ejected for punching an opponent in the head.
A couple penalties fly on this incompletion here.
I think they're both going to be on the Vipers. I think the defensive end who jumped, I didn't see what number it was. I think he then ended up punching him. Yeah, Mount jumped. I think they called that. And then I think he punched the offensive lineman under the chin. I think it's going to be on both on the defense. Let's sort that out here.
Dead ball foul. No, we got to combine them both. So I'm going to have 53 defense and 97 points. Do you want him gone? Okay, two fouls on the play. Two fouls on the play.
Correct.
97's gone. 97 is going to go. There are two fouls on the play. Offsides. Defense number 53. By rule, that penalty's declined. After the play was over. Personal foul, 97 defense for throwing a punch. He has been disqualified. 15-yard penalty.
Ejection, disqualification. Orlando, hit the bricks, man. That's how you know this XFL is different from the original. In the original, they would have crowned this guy league MVP for punching a guy in the head. Now, punching a guy in the head gets you ejected. Man, how times have changed. And not for the better either, I might add. So yeah, I think I'm going to hold my fire a little bit longer for the XFL. There are things I saw that I liked. Time will tell with this league. Just like time will tell about whether or not that post-game celebration from the St. Louis Battlehawks is the coolest or most pathetic thing ever. Because if the question was, how do you celebrate an XFL win? Nick Fitzgerald and Taylor Heineke have got the answer by going stone cold on some hard seltzers. You tell me, how's that gonna age? Partying like rock stars or partying like soccer moms? We're going to look back on two backup XFL quarterbacks slamming hard seltzers in a corporate tie-in and think that was like the coolest thing ever? Or are we going to say that was the most 2019 thing in 2020 ever and just keep moving? I think I know the answer, but I'm going to need at least one more week of the Battlehawks and the Roughnecks before I give you my final answer because, again, I am not here to hate. I'm here to keep an open mind. And back to the original scramble, the original XFL that had that scramble. You remember that, the scramble? You know, instead of a coin toss, they had a couple of dudes race to the ball 10 yards away and fight for the ball, and guys were separating their shoulders. Now, that was good TV. That was really good TV. That was actually good football. Killian Tilley is my guest. Killian, great to have you on the show. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Man, I'm great. Really good to have you. All right, so let me ask you about St. Mary's. They're a team that got you in the conference tournament final last March. You know how good they are. You know how tough they can be at home especially. So what was your team's mindset and approach going into that game on Saturday night?
I mean, we know St. Mary's is always a good team, and especially in their gym. So, we got a great mindset coming into the game, energy, and I think we played hard right away, and and it showed right away.
You know, for those who didn't see it, you're right. They're tough. They're always tough, and they're especially tough in their building. You went 7-for-10 from the field, including 3-of-5 from deep. And as a team, you were up by 34 in the second half before you finished off that 90-60 win. That was St. Mary's worst home loss since 2001. So I got to ask, what's it like when the team is playing like that? You're being patient on offense, you're getting all the right looks, and you're knocking them all down. What's it like to be in the middle of a zone like that team-wide?
Yeah, as you said, we were really patient, and we were just taking great shots every time. And I feel like when you take great shots, shots go in right away. And I think we did also a great job defensively. They didn't make any threes in the first half, and that's what kind of stopped them and made us get a big lead at half.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, the defense, because it's so easy to focus on what you guys did offensively, but there was actually a 7-minute stretch in the first half where you guys did not allow St. Mary's to score. They didn't make a single three at all in the first half. So in terms of mindset, how would you describe the team's approach to defense?
Yeah. I mean, we know we got the best offense in the country, so our focus is mostly defense. We know we still got a lot of improvement to do in defense, and we did a great job this game, just limiting their threes and just being focused on the scouting report. And the whole team was great with that.
Gonzaga's Killian Tilley is my guest. Now, you were playing in that game coming off an injury. From the outside, it seemed like you were great. Mark Few said afterwards, though, you were hitting all your shots, despite the fact that you were maybe just 50 to 60%. So how good did it feel to come back, and how did you feel out there?
I mean, you know, it's always just fun to be on the court. I've missed a lot of times, so every time I'm on the court, I'm just so excited. And I just play with a lot of energy, and it's just fun when the shots go in and the teammates find you open, and it's just always fun to be back with the team.
That's amazing. That was the 25th win of the season, which means it is the 13th straight season that the program's won at least 25 games. I understand that you're focused on bigger things, but how much pride do you and the team have in continuing streaks like that and keeping that going?
Yeah, I mean, Gonzaga has a huge history. All the teams in the past were doing did great, and so it's important to just keep continuing the legacy and keep continuing the good work, and yeah, it's a great program, and yeah, obviously you say that we got bigger things to do, and we got a bigger goal than that, and hopefully we can do it this year.
Killian Tilley is my guest. All right, so in terms of history, legacy, the program, obviously there's so much to like about it. When you were being recruited, though, what was it about Gonzaga that made you feel like that was the place for you?
I mean, just, you know, the experience they had with international guys and bigs, you know, had Domas, Sabonis, Ronny Turiaf, Karnowski, all these guys. It was just the best fit for me. And just, you know, the city of Spokane is amazing behind the Gonzaga, and the community is amazing, so it was just the best option for sure.
All right, so it's a great program, it's a great town, you got a great coach, which I'll ask you about in a minute, but at the end of last season, you could have gone to the NBA, but ultimately you chose to come back. Ultimately, what made you return to Gonzaga? What was that process like for you?
I mean, yeah, I had the chance. I could have probably left, but I think, you know, I had a tough season last year with a lot of injuries, and just wanted to prove that I could stay healthy and could keep playing. And also I had one more thing to accomplish at Gonzaga, is to win the national championship. You know, I did everything. I went to a Final Four. I done 88, 216. But my last thing is to win the national championship. So I got one more chance to do it, and I'm excited for March.
You actually stole my next question. I was going to say, you played on that team that went to the national championship game back in 2017. Like, what was that run like for you, and how much does that motivate you and drive you to get back to the tournament and make another deep run?
I mean, first of all, this experience was just crazy. It just brought it up for me personally. But, yeah, it also made me, like, you know, we were so close from winning the title that, you know, it just keeps a goal in me and keeps me motivated to win one. And yeah, I'm excited for the end of the year.
We're talking Gonzaga basketball. Killian Tilley is my guest. You know, I mentioned Mark Few. Every time I have him on the show, we talk about the Gonzaga way. Like, how would you describe the Gonzaga way of playing in games, practicing, and overall being a team? What is the Gonzaga way to you?
The Gonzaga, I think it's just kind of a family. You know, everybody's just so close from each other, and everybody just loves each other and just play for another. And you know, that's how we play the Zag way. Just share the ball. Everybody be patient. Everybody do their role, know their role, and that's how we do it here.
See, that's the thing. I've known Mark Few for a long time, and if you listen to him, it always sounds like that. It's a family. I mean, it definitely is a family. He's the patriarch. It comes off like that. He comes off as a really kind of laid-back, maybe not laid-back, but a relaxed guy. At the same time, man, yeah. If you know this guy, he is fierce, all right? Let's not get this twisted. My man is a fierce competitor. What's it like to play for Mark Few?
I mean, he's great. He's a great coach. You know, he's a legend here. And it's amazing to be with him. You know, it's been 3 years, 4 years now that I've been with him, and it was just great. He's giving me confidence right away, and so I will always be thankful for that. And I'm just really happy I chose Gonzaga for my few, for sure.
Right, so let me finally ask you this. You guys, and you're so locked in, I can tell. Like, you're playing through the season, and when you have the kind of success that the program has had, you could see where maybe you kind of, the regular season, you know, you're looking for the big picture. You could see where maybe you'd get a little bit complacent in the regular season. It could happen to anybody or any program. It does not happen there. How are you able to stay so focused on doing what you have to do during the regular season?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously, teams could just, you know, lose focus in a few games and lose some games. But I think we just take every game so seriously that we just say every time that every game is a championship mentality, and we prepare like that. The coaches make sure we prepare like that for every game. And
like, I get my government is James Philip Rome, not Richard E. Roper. We talk ball and stick and ball, not film and cinema. I get that. So if you're so devoid of the mental capacity to tolerate a few minutes on the number one trending item in America, because it is pop culture, it is not sports, I have to recognize this, and so do you. If you can't roll with that, if that's not why you're here, you don't want to hear it, just sit this one out. It's going to take 5 minutes. Because as an accomplished actor from Oscar-worthy films such as Space Jam, Two for the Money, The Longest Yard, all right, I know normally you might say, hey, don't talk about something you've never done. I have. I've done it. I have acted in movies, in television, and I don't mean like the talk show that I do. I mean sitcoms, dramedies, movies. I've done this, so I know what I'm talking about. So I am going to talk about the Academy Awards for one moment. Three words for you. Deal with it. I don't think I need to tell you to deal with it because so many of you wanted to do it. Oh, and before I start on the Oscars, I do have a legitimate question. It's 11:05 Pacific time. Is Renee Zellweger still bumping her gums? No, I mean, is she still talking? Is she still going? Is she still invoking the names of athletes in the oddest, most meandering speech of all time? I ask because I don't want to talk over her. I don't want us stepping on each other. For all I know, she's still up on the road, or still up the road from where I am right now, droning on in an empty room. And since nobody gave her the Jaws music last night, I don't want to step on her speech. Somebody find out. Somebody look into that. Obviously, she was not hit with the, hey, you got 5 minutes, all right? And 5 minutes means 5 minutes. Oh, she's done. Are you sure? All right, cool. I'll go on then. So the Oscars last night, to me, can be summed up in just one word. Weird! Normally, weird is good. That was not good. It was just weird. If you want a second word, if that word does not work for you, how about this one? Long. long ass. I mean, very weird and very long. Like 3 hours and 30 minutes long. Like almost halfway through The Irishman, long. Speaking of which, the reason that movie didn't win anything last night is because nobody in the history of the world has finished watching it yet. Except when the 2021 Oscars do get here, look the hell out. That film could clean up big time, and by then people should be done watching it. Here's an idea to speed things up. I mean, do you really need like a 3.5 hour show? I don't think so. Maybe if you want to shorten things up a little bit, tighten things up, maybe you stop with all the musical performances. Like, I know it's a bizarre concept to cut down on all music at a movie award show. But what do you say you take out the 15 songs played last night, and then all of a sudden you've got yourself a nice, snappy little 90-minute production? Then everybody's happy, and it's tight, and it keeps moving. I don't know. If you've ever seen the Grammys, have you? They don't stop that show every 10 minutes to start showing full-length movies. And that thing moves along pretty well. Then again, if you cut the music from the Oscars, we'd miss on what was one of the all-time what the bleep moments ever. I mean, certainly of this year, but I'm going to argue one of the most what the bleep moments ever happened when this went down. That's right. Eminem. My man comes out and he performs an 18-year-old track from his 2002 classic, 8 Mile. And even right now, no one really knows why. I mean, no disrespect to the guy at all. That's not what I'm here for. No disrespect to the man. But what was he doing there?
What were you doing there?
Oh, it's so fine he's there. Why was he doing that song there? Like, the only good byproduct of that totally random performance were the totally random reactions from the crowd, which the director was in awe of. He could not stop cutting away to a bunch of old, confused, dolled up Hollywood A-listers head bopping and rapping along while sitting down. Go look it up. Google it. Google crowd reactions to Eminem. It is cringy. Really cringy. Almost impossible to watch. After taking multiple camera shots of the human versions of the Taco Bell mild sauce packets. And somebody explain that to me, by the way. The mild sauce. What's the point? The director happened to catch Marty Scorsese napping it out towards the end of the performance. Literally. Like all narcoleptic. Like napping it out. I mean, I'll say this. I hope the paycheck was worth that, my man. Because that was a painfully awkward, weird, and totally bizarre 4 minutes of TV. An Eminem concert broke out at the Oscars. And all anybody can think of is, like, why?
Why?
Why? Besides, like, James Corden and Rebel Wilson clowning themselves for the movie Cats, Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph proving that, I guess, if you're going to have a host, let them host it next year. Most of it was pretty forgettable. Like, there was no mix-up with the Best Picture like there was a few years back. There was no scathing Ricky Gervais-style monologue. Certainly no Travolta butchering anybody's name.
The wickedly talented one and only Adele Dazeem.
And no, I don't need to weigh in on Joe Phoenix's speech. Depending on who you are, either it was the greatest thing you ever heard and it was gospel, or you hated it and poured a little extra milk into your coffee and cereal today as a bleep you to the guy. Teach their own, whatever. Take what you want from it. Keep moving. Huge shout out to Parasite for making history last night and becoming the first foreign film to ever win Best Pick. No one ever has any complaints with that. It's the kind of film that you see, it sticks with you forever because it's not like anything you've ever seen before, right? Like a total game changer. But all in all, top to bottom, I would say just a weird night. Oscars were weird. And they were long. And I was hoping to see Dallas Huff seat filling. I didn't see that. Instead, I got Marty Scorsese seat snoozing to a live, random Eminem performance. Unforgettable films this year, capped off by a largely forgettable award show and Marty losing himself and his consciousness in the moment. Peter DeBoer, good to have you. So last night was your first home game as Vegas Golden Knights head coach. I know the result was not what you were looking for, but overall, how was the experience?
Oh, it was unbelievable. You know, it's the most electric building in the league. The fans pack it in there, and they're loud, and they're on their feet, and it's a combination hockey game and rock concert type environment. So as an opposing coach coming into that building, it was always really tough. It was nice to be on the home bench for it, and the fans were great. We wish we could have given them a better result, but it was a great night.
All right, so you look at the last few weeks. For instance, the team announced that you would be the head coach on January 15th. You made your debut on the 16th, and that was roughly just a month after you and San Jose parted ways. I mean, what an unusual time. What have the last few weeks been like for you?
Oh, it's been a whirlwind. You know, we've had some epic battles with Vegas over the years, the last 3 years in San Jose in the playoffs and in the regular season. So when my phone rang for my next coaching opportunity after I was let go by San Jose, I would have put Vegas right near the bottom of the list of teams that I thought might call. But I was pleasantly surprised and happy. It was obviously a great situation, a great city, and a great team. And I couldn't wait to take the job and accept and get here and get to work.
Right. Like, you made that point pretty clear that you know what that place is about. You know what the passion's about. You know what that fan base is about. But when you take over in the middle of the season, there's always that balance between making changes, but at the same time, you want to be conscious of the fact that the clock is ticking. You've got an eye on the playoffs. So when you first came in, what were some of the biggest things that you wanted to address immediately?
Well, that's exactly right. I had never taken over mid-season before, so I leaned on some friends of mine. Paul Maurice coaches the Winnipeg Jets. He had done it twice before during his coaching career, and he gave me some advice. And basically, it was just, you know, try not to overwhelm them with changes. And so we picked a couple things. We wanted to get at the penalty killing and try and sharpen that up a little bit from where it was standing. And we wanted to defend harder. This is a team that, with a lot of talent, that's always been able to score, but we wanted to make sure we were defending harder and playing playoff-type hockey. So I think we've had a real receptive group. Even the games we've lost, we've played very well in. We went into Tampa and lost against arguably the best team in the league, and I thought outplayed them for most of the game. And, you know, even the other night against Carolina, we lost at home, we could have been up by 3 or 4 going into the third period. So there's been a lot of positive signs, and hopefully more to come.
Peter DeBoer joining us. You know, you mentioned that you thought that Vegas might be one of the teams at the bottom of the list that might give you a phone call. If I were to take a step back, like, it would have been really understandable if you said that you want to take the rest of the season off. Why was it important for you to jump right back into this, and why was that the opportunity that made you feel like that was the right reason to jump back in?
Well, there's only 31 of these jobs in the world, and you know, you really can't be picky or choosy. I think that was always my mindset when I got out, and I think coaches want to coach. I think, you know, the idea of having time off and recharging is great for a week or two, and then you start to get itchy to get behind a bench again. So I had a month off. There's only 31 of these jobs, and if I lined up the 31 jobs in the league, this job would be right at the top of the list. So it was a pretty easy decision.
I appreciate that response. Peter DeBoer joining us. Now, a big part of coaching, obviously, is about relationships and the connection you have to the players. And again, this is unusual because you joined midstream. How do you go about trying to get on the same page as the players and develop those relationships with them essentially on the fly during the middle of the season?
Yeah, that's the tough part. You've got to try and get to know them really quickly, you know. And the nice part was we started on the road. I took the job, and we had 7 road games in a row, which was a little daunting from a coaching perspective. But it was a blessing from getting to know them, because when you're on the road, they're at the rink longer. They're around the hotels. They're not leaving to head home to their families. So it really gave me an opportunity to spend some quality time with them and really try and speed that process up a little bit.
Yeah, Peter, I was going to say, was that the nice part? I mean, they start seven games in a row on the road. I mean, I guess you have to bond and you get to know each other a little bit. I'm not sure that's the nice part, though, right?
No. You know, usually when they make a coaching change, they try and put it in a soft part of the schedule where the new coach has an opportunity to really come in and have some early success. And when I looked at the timing of it and looked that we had seven in a row on the road, I'm not sure I felt real comfortable about that. But you know what? We found a way. We went 4-2-1 and in some tough buildings, and the guys really galvanized. So it worked out.
Peter DeBoer joining us for a few more moments. It did work out. So if we were to go back to Thursday's win over Florida, for instance, Mark Stone had a couple of goals and three assists in that game. But afterwards, you were talking about what he did defensively. When you see somebody like him buying in the way he has, and he's back-checking, and he's giving himself up and sacrificing himself defensively, what does that mean to you and the team to see that?
Well, it's a great sign. You know, the two Stanley Cup finalist teams that I've had in New Jersey and in San Jose, the best players were always the most honest players. In New Jersey that year, it was Zach Parise. He was our captain. And in San Jose, it was Joe Pavelski and Joe Thornton. And those guys, that was in their DNA. They played as hard away from the puck and defensively as they did offensively. And when your best players do that, it's contagious and you really have a chance to win. And when you see that out of Mark Stone, who in my mind is our best player, you know, I see a lot of similarities in the groups between those groups, and that's a great thing.
All right, so you and I talked for a couple of moments about you've had two teams go to the Stanley Cup final. You've coached in countless other playoff games. One of the things, Peter, you said, quote, "I feel I know what buttons to push to have success at that time of year," end quote. I mean, certainly your track record suggests that. There's no guarantee of success, but what are the buttons that you're looking to push at that time of year?
Well, we played in the 4 years I was in San Jose, we played 60 playoff games. So, you know, I think when you go to war with a group at that time of year, I think you have to rely on your depth, and your depth has to feel important. I think you set the table for that during the regular season. So that everybody feels like their part is as important as everybody else's. You know, but I also think, you know, the ability to focus on one team for a seven-game series as opposed to the regular season where you're in and out of cities and spending a little bit of time, I think the ability to get the group to focus on the strengths and weaknesses of that opponent for those 2 weeks and try and come out on the right end of it, you know, is something that we take a lot of pride in.
You know, finally, you mentioned that there's only so many jobs, so when there's an opportunity, you got to take a hard look. But at the same time, I don't think that you're jumping at this opportunity unless there's a lot of upside, and there is. Have you spent enough time with this group yet to get a sense of whether or not the pieces are in place right now to do something special with this group?
There's a lot of upside here. You know, I think every coach that you interview will tell you, if he's being honest, there's always another piece you can add or a part of the lineup that you'd like a little bit of help with. But I can tell you in all honesty that this is a group that is a contender and is very close to having a chance to win. You know, you come playoff time, you have to stay healthy, you have to get some bounces, your goalies have to be good. But we're right there.
Peter, one thought. You mentioned the playoffs. Maybe this is subject to debate. I believe this wholeheartedly. I just feel like the Stanley Cup or the NHL postseason is different than any other in the sense that it really is a war of attrition. You mentioned you want to have the right guys to go to battle with. I'm talking about a month long of playing every other night where literally every single, not just period, every shift matters. What's that grind like, the war of attrition that is the NHL postseason?
Well, that's exactly what it is. I think it's the best playoff in any sport because of the physicality. And, you know, our season's so long and the travel's tough that you don't see as much of that night to night in the regular season. But when you get to that time of year, hockey players have a way of ramping that part up, which I think you know, really makes a difference in the entertainment value in the game. And it really is a war out there. The physical piece of it goes to a whole nother level. So, and the teams that stay healthy get it. The year we played Pittsburgh in the final with San Jose, Joe Pavelski got hurt, Thomas Hertl got hurt, and really affected us. And I think when you're playing for a Stanley Cup, you've played two-plus months of playoff hockey to that point, four rounds, 2 weeks each round, it is a grind, and your group has to be mentally and physically tough.
So if it's that much of a grind, and it is, and you need to be healthy and you need to have luck, how long before, quote, load management finds its way to the NHL?
Yeah. Well, it's already here. I can tell you that. It is already here. I've had it. I had Joe Thornton. He's 40 years old in San Jose. And, you know, while we didn't healthy scratch him, we definitely managed his minutes and more importantly, his practice days. We've got Marc-Andre Fleury here in net for us in Vegas. And, you know, he's 34, 35-year-old goaltender now that's our starter. And, you know, we talk about load management with him, both in starts and also in practice time. So, you know, we're not at the NBA point where I think we're scratching players yet, but it's definitely in our conversations as far as practice days and off days.
Let's not get there. Let's not get that far yet, but I understand it. He is the head coach of the Vegas Golden Knights. He was named the Golden Knights head coach on January 15th, led New Jersey and San Jose both for the Stanley Cup Final. Peter, you and I are now officially all caught up. Nice to have you back. Great to have you on the show, and good luck. Hope we can do it again soon.
Thanks, Jim. Always a pleasure.
Good night now!